coming to you across the ether at the speed of light. It's the Mortgage Moment with Mark Wells of Preferred Financial. My friends tell me I have a face for radio, and Kerry Deese, our ninja processor, fending off those evil underwriters. To get your loan approved, grab a cup of coffee. Join us for the next hour as we talk about the mortgage industry. Today we'll cover planning for housing in retirement. A big deal for a lot of us who are looking towards retirement in the next few years. So, Kerry, our class of borrowers that we would call not only retirees, but really people that are planning to retire over the next few years, there are so many things that can be done ahead of time that will make housing in retirement run so much better for them that we want to cover some of the specifics. How we cover income for retirees once we are retired, whether it's better to buy that downsized house before you retire or after you retire. So we're going to cover a pretty broad range of things today. There are many things that retirees need to consider, or people contemplating retirement, that sometimes planning as much as 10 years ahead of time can give you a real advantage when you get there. Some of the considerations are you planning to downsize the house you live in, take the house you're living in and trade down? If so, you have to watch out for the tax man, because he can come knocking if you buy a new house that's worth less than your existing house. You may be planning, when you retire, to move to a resort area. So you may want to look at buying that house while you still have regular income, buy it as a second home, and then be able to move into it when you retire. Your income and the structure of your income that you'll take in retirement and how that might affect your qualifying for a home in retirement is important to look at. And then we're going to look at some other options, reverse mortgages for purchasing a retirement home or for eliminating the mortgage payment on your current home in retirement as part of your plan. And lastly, we'll talk about some estate planning issues, how you might dispose of your current home, particularly if a family member may want to purchase it or inherit it from you. So as we look at some of the considerations for retirees, let's take the first one and talk about downsizing. Many people, once they get to retirement, they don't want the 3 acres of grass to cut or the 5 acres of leaves to rake. And so they're looking at moving into a smaller home with a smaller lot, and sometimes townhouses. That's a popular option, or a condo. When you downsize, the one thing that you have to keep in mind is that you have been deferring the capital gains from the sale of your previous homes all of this time, which means that maybe your first house you bought was a $50,000 house, and when you sold it, you normally would have paid a capital gain on that, but you deferred it under the tax laws. You deferred it by buying another house of equal or greater value than the one you sold. And even though you didn't pay taxes at the time, it doesn't mean that you don't have to pay taxes. And as you move from house to house, you're always allowed to sell your existing home, acquire a new home at the same or greater value, and not pay the capital gains on that sale. But what happens when you get to retirement and all of a sudden you don't want to replace the large home that costs more with a larger home that costs even more? Well, fortunately, there is a one-time capital gains exclusion, and that is when you do in retirement downsize and you buy a home of lesser value from the one that you sold. Fortunately, you get to exempt from capital gains taxes $250,000 of the gain in the sale if you're an individual, or $500,000 as a couple. And this is kind of a lifesaver for many retirees, because taxes, capital gains taxes, although they're taxed at half the rate of regular income, it's still a significant tax.
And for those of us not as familiar with capital gains, what exactly, briefly, are capital gains?
Capital gains is basically the difference in what you sell your house for compared to what you originally bought it for.
Okay.
So if you bought a $50,000 house, you sold it for $100,000, you would have a $50,000 capital gains, and that would be subject to a capital gains tax.
Okay.
However, in the case of a primary residence, the IRS lets you defer that, but eventually the birds come home to roost. When you ever downsize, then you have to face, is this the time that I'm going to take my one-time exemption and not pay taxes, or just bite the bullet and pay the taxes?
We're jumping into all this technical stuff really early on this show, aren't we?
I know. Probably nobody's awake enough to even be with us, but take another jolt of coffee and let's see if we can move on. One thing we find a lot of retirees doing is they're going to change locations. Not only do they want to downsize, but they may just want to get out of here and live in a place that's always been, you know, the place that they like to take vacations in, the mountains, the beach, a lake house. One of the things that can be a part of retirement planning is purchasing that home early while you're still employed, because you can buy another home in a resort setting as a second home. And the good news is that second home interest rates are not any higher than interest rates on a primary residence. The advantage to purchasing it early may be that you have the qualifying income at the time to take on the other house payment, where you may choose to structure your retirement pay in a manner that works for you financially but doesn't work for you in terms of having the qualifying income to buy that house in that resort. So an early look at how you might want to transition from your current housing into a house in a resort area might include the decision to buy early in preparation for retirement rather than waiting to retire when the income may not be sufficient to do it. We also, one of the things we need to really cover in detail, and we will, is how will the structure of your income change once you're retired? Because again, much of our financial planning involves avoiding the tax man at any time. Sometimes things that are financially astute to do that increase your retirement income for in as much as you can use it don't necessarily translate to qualifying income the way a lender looks at it. So you don't want to fall into the trap of structuring your retirement income in a manner that may work financially, but then kind of kills your home transition, which you plan to do at retirement. And then, as I mentioned, we're going to spend our last segment in a lot more detail on reverse mortgages. A lot of misconceptions about those. We're going to talk about reverse mortgage options for purchasing, as well as reverse mortgage options for remaining in the home that you're in and just eliminating the mortgage payment. So, Kerry, let's talk about retirement income from a lender's perspective. And let's start with the biggie. All of us, when we retire, most all of us going to draw Social Security income. And when you get that little Social Security check, it's one of those sleights of hand where the government gives and the government takes away. So deducted from your Social Security check is going to be your Medicare deduction. How do the lenders treat the Medicare deduction, Kerry? Do they subtract that from income? They take that away from you? How do they treat that?
They actually don't pay any attention to that deduction. It doesn't help or harm you.
Okay, so in your Social Security, we're going to use the gross amount that you receive, mm-hmm. not the net amount you get after they've deducted the Medicare. And then there's a further enhancement with Social Security income that's different from any other kind of income, and that is we can perhaps increase the Social Security income. How can we do that?
Just depending on the loan program, you can increase it by either 15 or 25%.
And why can you do that? Why can you take a $1,000 Social Security check and say, well, for qualifying income, this is worth $1,250?
That just keeps us in line with the typical W-2 borrower whose wages we look at from the gross pay standpoint.
And their wages are taxed.
Mm-hmm.
Social Security is not taxed. And they allow us in the debt ratios to gross it up so that it's equivalent to W-2 wages of a borrower. Again, slightly different grossing up, 15% for FHA loans, but 25% for conventional loans. Underwriting guidelines calculate debt ratios off gross income, and so the untaxed portion of your Social Security income can be increased as qualifying income, even though you don't actually receive that greater amount. When we get back, some of you in retirement may be planning to work part-time. Many, because you're experts in your field, become consultants. So we need to talk about how that income will be looked at when you get to retirement. We'll see you on the other side of the break in just a few minutes.
More technical information way too early on a Saturday morning. And if you ever need to listen to us again, feel free to go to our website at preferredfinancialgreenville.com. We've got all of our shows saved there. You can email us at themortgagemoment@gmail.com or call us at 864-235-9596.
Thanks, Carrie, and do feel free to call us anytime. Contact us by email. Check out our other programs on our website. That's a good way to keep up with all this information we're throwing at you. We're talking today about retirement income, and many retirees don't entirely quit. They may quit the job that they're doing, but many enjoy working part-time and want to include part-time income as part of their qualifying income when they go to buy a house. Carrie, if we have someone who is just taking on part-time income, how are we able to treat that income when they go to get a mortgage?
If they're just taking on the part-time income, we won't be able to use it. If you listened to our show on income a couple of weeks ago, this will sound familiar to you. There is that two-year rule that you'll hear us mention a lot.
That's right. The two-year rule comes into play. So this is where retirement planning may drive you to do something earlier than you intended to do, buy the house early while you still have full-time employment. Because if you transition to part-time employment, until you have a two-year history of that same part-time employment, and that is on the same job, doing the same thing, you can't count a bit of it. And this could leave you short when you go to buy your retirement home. So part of your retirement planning needs to take into account this transition of income. How about consulting? A lot of people, again, who have years, 40, 45 years in an industry and have a wealth of experience, become consultants. So, Carrie, when someone chooses to become a consultant, what happens to the income they earn from consulting? Can we count that too?
Well, when you go into consulting, your income is actually considered self-employed income. And much like part-time income, we run into that two-year rule again.
And the two-year rule comes into play because for any self-employed borrower, you must have been self-employed for 2 years to count any of the income. And then it's an averaging. So for part-time income and consulting income both, it would be necessary to have worked in that capacity for 2 years, and then we would have to average the earnings from those 2 years. In the case of part-time, average the gross earnings. But in the case of consulting income, we've got the other complication that because you're self-employed, you're probably going to deduct some of your traveling expenses, some of your business expenses, and your qualifying income is not the gross receipts you receive as a consultant, but the net income you report as a result of your business activity. Again, this needs to be factored into your retirement planning and home planning in retirement. Other common forms of income in retirement, we would have to cover annuity income. Carrie, how is annuity income counted when someone applies for a mortgage?
As long as it doesn't terminate in less than 5 years, you can use 100% of that income to qualify.
That's correct. And you can use that, Carrie, from day one? Do you have to have it for 2 years or anything?
No, you can do it from day one.
Okay. So if you have a contract, an annuity is a contract to pay you money. And if contractually that money will be paid to you for at least 5 more years, you can count it from the first day you receive it as part of your qualifying income. Now, there are tax-free annuities. And again, in retirement, any income that is legitimate qualifying income that is tax-free can be grossed up. In other words, it can be increased since debt ratios are calculated according to standard W-2 statutory borrowers who pay taxes on their income. So that's another advantage if you have a tax-free annuity. It's actually worth more as qualifying income than what you're receiving. IRA income, this is one we get all the time. There are a number of rules regarding when and if and how much income you can use off of an IRA. Let's start first of all, Carrie. There is a mandatory withdrawal age that everyone reaches that is at 70 and a half.
I have.
And I've always wondered, okay, does that mean you've got to take a full year of income in that last half year that you become eligible? I don't know. We need to ask a CPA about that. But the mandatory withdrawal age on an IRA is 70 and a half. At that point, the IRA stipulates that you must take out a certain annual amount of income. How does the lender count that income, Carrie, that you withdraw from an IRA?
If you're 70 and a half, you can qualify with 100% of that manual withdrawal amount.
Of the mandatory withdrawal amount, that's right. So if the IRA is worth $1 million and the IRS says you have to take out $100,000 a year, well, the lender's going to count all of that as qualifying income. What if you're not 70 and a half, but you still have a big IRA? How does the lender treat that?
Well, as long as you are 59 and a half, you can schedule your IRA income out over 20 years to count it as qualified income.
Okay, so the magic 59 and a half is the age at which you can take money out of an IRA without paying the tax penalties. So the lender says, okay, if you're 59 and a half years old, you can take the amount of money in your IRA, divide it by 20 years, and they will credit you with that much annual income. So if you have $1 million in an IRA, you divide that by 20 years, that's $60,000 a year, and they will count, the lender will count that $60,000 as qualifying income. Now, here's the great thing. They will count it as income even if you don't take it out.
Really?
So you don't have to actually withdraw it or have it on a withdrawal schedule. You just have to be able to do it, be 59 and a half, and then that counts as income even if you're not actually taking it out. There are special kinds of other retirement plans. One is called a SEP IRA. A SEP IRA is actually the same as a standard IRA, except withdrawals on a SEP IRA are not taxed because you pay taxes on the money before you put it into the SEP IRA. How does a lender, Carrie, treat a SEP IRA income?
Same as a standard, except you can gross it up because it's not taxed.
That's exactly right. So your SEP IRA withdrawal can be increased by 15% if you're getting an FHA loan, 20% if you're getting a conventional loan, 25% if you're getting a conventional loan, and it's worth more than the actual income you're taking out as far as the lender's concerned. How about 401k income? Many of us have 401ks. How do lenders treat 401k income?
The same as the standard IRA income. Mandatory withdrawal amount after the 70 and a half. And if you're 59 and a half, you can spread it out over the 20-year term to take the income from that.
And withdrawal tables are really identical for a 401k as they are for an IRA. That's why you can convert a 401k to an IRA rollover at any time. It's not necessary to do that when you're buying a house. The lender's going to count the income in the same way, whether it's sitting in a current 401k or whether you've rolled that over into an IRA vehicle. Carrie, I have a question that comes up often with borrowers who have substantial liquid assets. Beyond their retirement accounts, they have been able to save a substantial amount of money. And always the question is, why, if I've got $500,000, won't they lend me $300,000 on this house? Why can't you just use assets as the basis for getting a loan?
You know, right now that is just not part of the standard loan programs that are allowed. But there are some programs that are called non-QM, which, you know, pretty much just means they're a little outside of the box. The rates are going to be higher on those loans, but sometimes they're a good option. They will allow you for 20-year scheduling out of those assets, similar to what you would do with an IRA.
That's right. So when we say non-QM, back after the crash, the government established among all the lending programs certain conditions under which a loan met minimum qualifying guidelines. If it meets those qualifying guidelines, it has certain protections that the government extends in terms of liabilities to the lenders that lend. But if a lender goes outside of the government-regulated lending guidelines, they can lend money any way they want to. It's their money. But it falls under a non-QM loan. It exposes them to a greater liability in foreclosure actions and other treatments. And because of that, the rates are higher on these. We've just been, in the last really 18 months to 2 years, begun to see some programs come into play that are like this. Regular standard Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, FHA, VA, no one will use a liquid asset as income because it's an asset. It's not income. However, these QM programs do the logical thing. They look at that asset and say, well, sure, he's got $500,000. He can afford a $300,000 loan. We will just count that asset as scheduled out income. So, you divide the asset by 20 years, and you get credit for that much money in an annual basis, and that can be used as qualifying income. Now, if you have a substantial liquid asset and you are already retired, you may want to go ahead and simply convert that asset into a constant income stream. We mentioned annuities earlier, and an annuity is just that. You generally pay a lump sum into an annuity holder, which are often insurance companies. They pay you back a fixed amount of money. Sometimes these are lifetime annuities, so the money you receive is a lifetime receipt. They're based on actuarial tables. Other times they are termed out over 5, 10, 15 years, whatever you might choose. If you convert an asset to an income stream, you can count that income immediately, as long as the income will go, how much longer, Carrie?
5 years.
5 years. And as long as you have are in receipt of the very first check. You have to show the contract for the annuity. You have to have received the first check, just like if we were counting job income. You have to show us your first check on your new job to verify that you're there. The first check from your annuity shows that you're receiving the annuity income, and you can count that as qualifying income. So if we were to summarize for our retirement-related borrowers, yes, we can use Social Security income and sometimes increase it, make it actually work for you more, even though you're not receiving more, because we can gross it up. Yes, you can receive and use part-time income, but you have to have been on that job for 2 years before we can use it. Same thing with consulting income, 2 years before we can use it. Annuity income, we can use from the day you receive it. IRA income, we can either use your mandatory withdrawal as income, or we can schedule your IRA out over 20 years if you're at least 59 and a half years old. Same thing with SEP IRA, but SEP IRA we can gross up. Same thing with a 401k income. We can use it just like an IRA and treat either the mandatory withdrawal amount or a 20-year term if you're at least 59 and a half. Assets, sometimes they can be used in non-QM loans, but not generally. We generally have to convert the asset to an income stream before we can count it. When we get back from the break, we're going to try to answer the question, well, is it just easier to apply for a mortgage before I retire, or should I wait until after I retire? We'll talk about those and reverse mortgage options when we get back off the break. Break. Thanks for being with us this morning. Hope you're into your second cup of coffee and wide awake. One thing that Gary and I have realized in doing this program is there is just a massive amount of information, and we're trying to communicate to you in a very condensed form many of the complexities that come along with mortgage financing. Sometimes that can be a jumble of confusion, so what we encourage you to do is to just reach out to us with any personal questions you have. Or if you just want a personal analysis of where you stand, where you might be wanting to go with your housing, your mortgage lending, we welcome your calls. You can reach us daily at 864-235-9596, Mondays through Fridays. You can also reach us at themortgagemoment@gmail.com. And you can also visit our website, where you'll have our programs posted. You can listen to them again there. Our website is preferredfinancialgreenville.com. Any of those methods, and by email, calls, however you need to get to us, we'll try to make this a lot simpler for your specific situation.
And, you know, guidelines change all the time. There are exceptions to rules. So even if you've heard us say something and you're not sure if you'll qualify, definitely just give us a call, because we might be able to work it out.
I think that's a real good thing to say, Carrie. What we try to do is cover the standard guidelines, but all guidelines are not set in concrete. They're not entirely black and white. And if you pull out the Fannie Mae guidebook, where all these regulations are, it's what?
It's 1,200 pages.
1,200 pages. We've got job security. We can do radio broadcasts until we retire, Carrie, because there's so much information. But we will try to distill that down to your specific situation, so that you don't have to comb through all of the extraneous information that doesn't apply to you. So give us a call when you need us. Let's talk a minute, Carrie. I have had many people who are planning ahead who come in and ask me, all right, I just need to go ahead and apply for a mortgage now before I retire? Or should I just wait until the dust settles after retirement and then decide what to do? As with any question, that can be a highly individualized answer. However, there's some things that you should be aware of in terms of the timing of all of this. On the one hand, if you're going to take action to acquire homes or refinance homes, you probably want to do that far enough ahead of retirement to where you don't get stuck in the middle. And on the other hand, out the other end, you may have to wait a little while before your retirement income kicks in a manner in which we can count it and make your planning according to that. Carrie, in regard to doing something before you retire, what is the one thing you don't want to do as far as initiating a new home purchase or a new refinance if you're getting very close to retirement?
You don't want to mention it to your employer, because when we go to verify employment, if they put on that form that you are going to be retiring, we won't be able to use that income for qualifying.
That's right. There's part of the all income qualifying guidelines that is based on expected continuity of income. And if you have turned in a retirement notice to your employer, your lender, when we get to the very last day before you close, they're going to call your employer. One of the questions they're going to ask is he still on the job? And the second is he planning to retire? And if you have put in your retirement notice, it is too late. Your transaction is dead in the water. You have killed your income, and we've got to go back in then and try to structure the loan according to your retirement income, not your pre-retirement income. Also, for people who may be in a job that has a mandatory retirement age. Now, particularly government jobs, most of them do have a retirement age at which you have to retire. We have to watch that also. You may not have given notice that you're retiring, but if, for instance, you're a state teacher, you may be forced to retire at age 65. And so you don't want to go applying for your retirement home when you're 64 and a half. Because the lender is going to say, well, there's not going to be continuity of this income. You're going to be in limbo for a while until, for instance, your pension income kicks in. Then you can qualify for your pension income. But we can't qualify you today for pension income you're going to receive a year from now. That's another kind of embedded rule, is that future anticipated income is no good to a lender. There has to be the definite receipt of that income. Maybe some other trades. Airline pilots have a mandatory retirement age, so you have to watch your timing as to when you go in to do retirement home financing. You either need to be prepared to qualify on your retirement income and wait until you're in receipt of that income, or you need to apply for mortgage financing well enough in advance of your retirement for us to be able to count your current income.
And how long is well enough in advance?
1 year at least.
Okay.
As long as we have a year, we're okay. We're ahead. Want to talk a minute about reverse mortgages. Of all the loan products out there, this is probably one of the most misunderstood products. Certainly, by far generates more questions than any other mortgage product, and yet can be one of the most valuable retirement strategies that you might need and want to put in place. Reverse mortgage is called reverse because everything's backwards. And so to get your mind around a reverse mortgage, sometimes you feel like you're having to think backwards. And that's what makes it inherently difficult. Actually, the government, before you can take out a reverse mortgage, is going to require you to go to an independent HUD-approved counselor just so they can make sure that you understand what a reverse mortgage is doing. So the things that we tell you as a mortgage broker or a lender, you've got to go get independent counseling that verifies what we've told you and verifies you understand it, because this product is different. It's not really that it's a dangerous product or anything like that. It's just it operates differently than a regular mortgage where you have borrowed money and you're going to pay it back on a regular basis. A reverse mortgage has no monthly payment. Well, how in the world do you do that? How do you buy a house and have no payment? Or how do you refinance a mortgage you have and and make no payment. We're going to have to talk about how that works, how it does it. So, at its base concept, a reverse mortgage allows a borrower to either remain in the house that they are currently living in for the rest of their lives without a mortgage payment, or, which is less known, you can actually purchase a home using a reverse mortgage, live in that house for the rest of your life, never have a mortgage payment. Well, that sounds like magic. But of course it's not. It's not magic at all. Let's talk about some of the misconceptions, things about reverse mortgages that people have all wrong. Carrie, what's the number one misconception in terms of a reverse mortgage?
How you hold title and your ability to sell the house if you wanted to.
That's right. Most people think that when you take out a reverse mortgage, the bank owns your house. You have deeded your house to them, and you're stuck. You got to live there for the rest of your life, or there's just nowhere to go. That is absolutely not true. You do not depart with your title when you take out a reverse mortgage loan. You do not depart with the power of disposition of your house. That means you can take out a reverse mortgage today and you can sell your house tomorrow. There is no restriction on that. One of the great misconceptions about reverse mortgages. The bank does not own your house. You own your house. You're still the lien holder. There's another common question we get, common misconception, and that is that if you take out a reverse mortgage, your children cannot inherit your house from you. But that is absolutely not true either. There were some restrictions in previous reverse mortgage programs, but that program is now standardized under FHA guidelines, and any of your children or relatives or heirs are allowed to purchase the house upon your death, just as they could or would if you had a regular mortgage on the house. Carrie, what are some of the other misconceptions about a reverse mortgage that we need to debunk?
That the bank profits from the sale of your house after your death.
That's correct. Again, you are not departing with title. So when the house sells, your estate will receive the profits from the sale of the house just like a regular house. If your house is worth $200,000 and the balance on your reverse mortgage is $150,000, your estate will make the $50,000 profit. That will go to your heirs. The bank does not profit from the sale of your house. Carrie, what happens in the reverse, though? What happens if somehow there were some real miscalculations here and the house is worth less than what is owed on the reverse mortgage? Can the estate be charged the deficit?
No, actually, it can't be charged with a deficit.
And that is the ultimate safety point. I bring that up because there were, in the early years of reverse mortgages, and I refused to book them because of this, there were clauses in previous types of reverse mortgages where the estate could be charged with a deficit. That is not the case anymore with the standardized FHA reverse mortgage, which is the only one available out there. The estate profits from the sale. They cannot be charged a deficit if the house doesn't sell for enough after the estate is settled. We'll be back right after the break. Join us for the conclusion of reverse mortgages. Down the home stretch. Thank you for joining us this morning on an early Saturday. We're talking about retirement planning as it pertains to housing, how you can prepare for your housing in retirement. We've been talking about reverse mortgages, and we want to cover that in a little more detail. Carrie, I mentioned that part of the mortgage, reverse mortgage process is that it is mandatory that you receive counseling from a HUD-approved counselor before you can actually enter into a reverse mortgage transaction. Some people want to get that before they talk to us about the particulars of the reverse mortgage. Sometimes people want some initial information about the reverse mortgage. But what do they need to do, and how can we get them to a counselor?
You know, just reach out to us. You can come in and see us. You can give us a call or even email us, and we'll give you a list of counselors, and we'll find one that's the closest to your area so you don't have to travel far.
Does everyone, you have to do that face-to-face? Does the counseling have to be done face-to-face?
No, they can actually do that over the phone or online.
Okay, so you do have the options. And there are local counseling services here in Greenville. There are in the upstate in Spartanburg. And we can get you to one of those face-to-face, or you can, as Carrie mentioned, do it over the phone or even online if you're computer savvy. So call us. You can reach us at 864-235-9596 or email us at themortgagemoment@gmail.com. And we'll provide that list to you so you can choose which way you want to go. It's good. I like to have a little preliminary conversation with a potential reverse mortgage client just to give them some numbers. And usually those numbers involve knowing what their current house is worth if we're going to refinance with a reverse mortgage, or conversely, how much house do they want to buy, and we can kind of provide those numbers. I'd like to talk about how it is possible that you can obtain a reverse mortgage and never make a payment. As I mentioned, it's not magic. It's not some sleight of hand. It's actually very simple. There are two factors that go into a reverse mortgage. One of those factors is the value of your house. How much is your house worth? That is going to partially determine how much you can get out. The second factor is a person's age. The reason the age is important in a reverse mortgage is that every month that you hold a reverse mortgage, a certain amount of interest accrues on that mortgage, just like it does on your regular home mortgage. Now, when you make a payment on a regular mortgage, you're paying the interest back every month. You're also paying a little bit of principal, so the balance on your regular mortgage goes down every month. Eventually, you pay it off. A reverse mortgage is not that way. It does what we call in the industry reverse amortization, which means instead of making the interest payment each month, you're not making any payment. The interest is added to the balance of the loan each month. Let's take some simple figures. If you have a $100,000 reverse mortgage and the interest rate on that is 5%, that mortgage is going to accrue interest of $5,000 in the first year that you own it and have it. So your balance at the end of the first year of that reverse mortgage is $105,000. You have made no payments on it, but the balance has increased, and that is called reverse amortization. The reason that your age is important is that we all have a statistical or an actuarial age. That just means that a bunch of people cooped up in some really tiny offices keep track of all of us when we die. And there is an average death age for all of us. It's called your actuarial or statistical death age. And all insurance products are based on this. So I tell people a lot of times a reverse mortgage is not terribly different from an insurance product. If you're going to claim an insurance benefit, that premium is a lot more expensive when you're 70 years old than it was when you're 20. Because you're going to die statistically at age 78, you've only got 8 years to pay a premium. And if you were 20, you had 58 years to pay the premium. A reverse mortgage is similar in that the older you are, the more you can borrow on a reverse mortgage. Why is that? Because you're not going to live as long. Now, that sounds a little gruesome, and we don't mean to be morbid about this, but a reverse mortgage is simply an actuarial insurance type based product that calculates your age and how long you're going to live, how much interest will accrue on that loan, and the amount you can get with your reverse mortgage is based on not exceeding the value of the home once you have reached a death age. Well, there are some other assumptions in a reverse mortgage loan, and we have to start with where your house is valued today, but someone also has to project, what will your house be worth 10 years from now, 20 years from now, or 30 years from now when you reach your actuarial death age? Of all the things involved in reverse mortgages, death statistics are very precise because we've kept death statistics for
Say that five times
yeah,
fast.
Yeah, that's right, really quick. We've kept those statistics for literally several hundred years since there have been life insurance products. We know what the death age is. The value estimation is also a statistical analysis. However, when we reach a period like we did in 2007 where the real estate market crashed, all of a sudden the assumption that real estate was going to keep going up and up and up turned out to be invalid. We had a number of years there where real estate values in some areas plummeted. We had markets like Las Vegas, South Florida, San Francisco, where values were cut in half all of a sudden. Well, this kind of made the actuarials that do projections of increasing real estate think twice, that we might not always have increasing real estate values. So adjustments were made in the reverse mortgage amounts to reflect new information that says, well, maybe houses don't go up every year and maybe they don't go up as much as we thought. But how much you can get out on a reverse mortgage is a factor simply of your current age, of what your house is worth, and according to your zip code, what the statistical likelihood is of your house increasing in value over the next years. We have to have the information, but if you plug that information in, everybody's reverse mortgage comes out the same. It's not really like other mortgages where the rate might make a big difference. The amount you can get out from a reverse mortgage is strictly your current age, value of your home, and what zip code you're living in. Now, Carrie, let's talk about when you take out a reverse mortgage to refinance. If you have an existing mortgage, can you pay that mortgage off with the reverse mortgage proceeds?
Absolutely.
And that's really the purpose of it. In fact, when you have a reverse mortgage, you're not allowed to have any other mortgage on the home. So if you are living in a home and part of your retirement plan is you've been making a $1,000 payment on your house every month and you're going into retirement, if you take out a reverse mortgage, if your age is correct and your value is enough, you will be able to pay off your existing mortgage, replace it with the reverse mortgage, and go from having a $1,000 payment going into retirement to having no payment going into retirement. But how do we use a reverse mortgage to purchase a home, Carrie?
They take the purchase price and your age to determine the amount of funds that you'll qualify for.
Okay, so if you have a $200,000 house, and let's say you're 67 years old, and you plug those numbers in and the zip code of the house in, and it says the reverse mortgage will give you $110,000 in funds to buy this home, where does the other $90,000 have to come from?
You actually have to bring that to closing.
Okay, so when you use a reverse mortgage for down payment, it's really not any different from using a regular mortgage. It's just the difference between the mortgage amount and the purchase price is the amount of down payment you have to make. So if you're retiring and you're selling a home, you may want to take the equity out of that home, for instance, use it as down payment, and couple it with a reverse mortgage to buy your new home. That way you enter into a new home with no mortgage payment, but you're buying more house than you could have bought with just the cash from the sale of your home. And this allows retirees to leverage into better housing, more expensive housing if they want to do that, rather than trying to go back to a purchase of a low-priced home that might not meet their needs and just use their cash to buy that home with. So reverse mortgages in purchases in retirement can be a great source of leveraging to get into the type of homes that you want to be in. Is there any restriction, Carrie, in the type of housing that you can purchase with a reverse mortgage?
No, there's actually not.
The only restriction you might find out there is in condominiums. And because reverse mortgages are insured by FHA, FHA must have to have already approved the existing condominium association for FHA financing. Now, we find that very few HOAs go through that process and very few developers go through that process.
Yeah, it's a pretty cumbersome process.
It is. So the only caution in planning to use a reverse mortgage to purchase a retirement home is if that retirement home is a townhouse, you're fine. But if that property is a condominium, a horizontal property regime, you will only be able to get a reverse mortgage if FHA has already previously approved the condominium association for FHA financing. Carrie, I want to cover the last of a few important items to remind our listeners that have to deal with some misconceptions, but also may make a reverse mortgage look like a wonderful transaction. And it can be. We have seen this program literally be a lifesaver. Carrie, you mentioned earlier when we were on break that a reverse mortgage does not have credit qualifying. So actually someone who may have experienced a severe credit disruption can get a reverse mortgage because you're not making a payment. There is no credit qualification.
Absolutely. We do have to explain it. They do want you to explain what happened, but they don't. You don't have to have a specific score or a number of open accounts to qualify.
That's right. So this can be a lifesaver. No score required for a reverse mortgage. Credit disruptions can be explained, but don't necessarily prevent you from getting a reverse mortgage like they would if you were getting a regular mortgage. Mm-hmm. Two things. If you take out a reverse mortgage today and you die next week, does your estate profit from the sale of the house?
Absolutely.
And if you take out that reverse mortgage and instead of dying next week, you live to be 120 and you owe a whole lot more than your house is worth, is the estate going to be charged a deficit?
Nope, no deficit.
So can an heir inherit the home that has had a reverse mortgage on it?
They can. They have a full year to pay off the mortgage balance.
That is correct. And the fair market value of that house is the basis under which the house can be sold to an heir. The lender cannot refuse to sell it to an heir at less than what is owed as long as there's a fair market appraisal. Thanks for joining us today. See you again next week on The Mortgage Moment.